Get the lowdown on the publishing industry. Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett. She talks to anyone who's anyone in publishing. Thursdays, 5 p.m.
on KCI-FM in Irvine.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Hi, I'm attorney Mari Frank, co-host of Privacy Piracy. How private is your confidential information? Who is watching you on surveillance cameras or listening in on your private phone conversations? Think of all the information you give up each day, from the fast-track scans on the morning commute to the credit card purchases at Starbucks to your cell phone tracking, airline ticket, car rental records, and even the logging of PC keystrokes at work. These bits of data are shared with companies and the government to create a detailed dossier of your daily activities. How are your profiles used, and what can you do to protect yourself? We'll answer these questions and more when you listen to Privacy Piracy, Wednesday evenings from 5 to 6 p.m. at KUCI 88.9 FM or www.kuci.org.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good evening and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and we're available via podcast, either through iTunes or at Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. Simply click on the radio tower on the top left side of your screen, which will lead you to the radio page. And near the top of that page is a link to archives of our past shows. This interview will join more than 150 others up and available to you now. And if you don't have the opportunity to listen to us live, this is a great way to ensure you don't miss out. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara for the next two or three shows. And as always, Writers on Writing features conversations with authors, poets, agents, publishers, anyone and everyone having to do with the art and business of writing. And tonight I'm joined by two men who wrote two incredible novels. Dominique Smith is with me now, and coming up in our second half hour, please stay with me because Peter Orner will be here. Dominique Smith grew up in Sydney, Australia, and now lives in Austin, Texas. He holds an MFA in writing from the Michener Center for Writers at the University of Texas at Austin. His short fiction has appeared in the Atlantic Monthly and been nominated for a Pushcart Prize. His awards include the Dobie Paisano Fellowship for the Texas Institute of Letters, the Sherwood Anderson Fiction Prize, and the Gulf Coast Fiction Prize. In 2006, his debut novel, The Mercury Visions of Louis Daguerre, was selected for the Barnes & Noble Discover New Writers Program. It also received the Stephen Turner Prize for First Fiction from the Texas Institute of Letters. But his latest novel, The Beautiful Miscellaneous, out last month and published by Atria, is the driving our discussion this evening. And because I always like to hear the author's take on what their work is really about, I'll allow Dominique to describe his latest novel, The Beautiful Miscellaneous, in further detail. So without further introduction, let's bring him on. Dominique, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. You know, this was just a stunning read. I receive a lot of books in the mail, and I always share them first with my neighbor across the street because she's a voracious reader, and she pops them back in my mailbox with little notes. And this one she personally handed back to me and said, "You have to call this man right now. He's
well,
written an incredible book."
I passed her litmus test.
You more than passed. She was delighted, and she was exactly right. This was just such a stunning read.
Well, thank you.
So for the listeners who aren't yet familiar with the book, why don't you first tell us a little bit about it, how it came
sure.
to be.
I guess the short version is that The Beautiful Miscellaneous is essentially about the average son of a genius. The main character, Nathan Nelson, is the son of a particle physicist of some renown. And during the 70s and 80s, he's kind of trotted during his childhood to kind of towards greatness. And he's taken to whiz kid summer camps and chess tournaments, and it's always expected that he will have this kind of big epiphany. But the reality is he's a little bit above average in just about everything he does. There's a line in the novel that he flits like a tadpole near the deepest place of the bell curve. Mm. And in some ways, that kind of summarizes both his father's quest for his greatness and his kind of lackluster performance. And the novel is really about the father-son relationship. There's a kind of twist in the novel where Nathan, after an accident, develops a condition known as synesthesia, which we can talk more about. But essentially, that leads him to have a prodigious memory. And although it's not anything like genius, it is an interesting talent that kind of causes the father-son relationship to be recast in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did the original idea for the book come to you? Did it start with an image or with a character?
It came in a couple different ways. There wasn't a single moment, but there were some stories along the way. One was, I heard a story from a friend whose college roommate was the daughter of someone who'd won the Nobel Prize in medicine. And there were some really interesting stories she shared with me about the way that this college student kind of functioned. She was socially withdrawn, had trouble kind of fitting in, barely went to classes, and was just generally found it very hard to kind of have a compelling reason to really kind of go at things. And that really refined my thinking about the way that genius functions in a family and what might happen if you have this kind of looming figure. Is it inspiring or is it paralyzing? There was another story or a set of stories that I heard, one of which was about a 10-year-old boy who developed a prodigious memory after he was hit in the head with a baseball. And that kind of opened up this whole kind of area for me about people who develop prodigious talents after an injury or an accident. I did quite a lot of research in that area, and I managed to correspond with a man named Dr. Daryl Treffert, who is the doctor who did the original consulting for the Rain Man movie. And he pointed me to other literature that, stories of people who had childhood meningitis and then became incredibly talented sculptors or painters. And so that really kind of made me think of those stories. On the one hand, there is genius and its effect on a family, and on the other hand, how a person's mental abilities might change through their lifetime. So those were kind of two of the stories that grounded it.
Mm-hmm. You touched on just how much research went into this. I don't know if you have a physics background, but But first of all, physics seems like kind of a dry subject to write about, and yet you managed to do it in a very, sort of dramatic, wonderful arc to the story sort of way. And it strikes me as just a lot of knowledge being woven into the novel. Mm-hmm. And you've told us kind of how you've done some of the research, but how do you know when you've done enough to kind of carry it through?
I think that's a really good question. I mean, I've been interested in physics and particle physics for a while, but I'm not a mathematician, and a lot of the nuts and bolts of physics is about mathematical proof. So I knew from the beginning that the challenge was how to make the physics dramatic. And so it occurred to me that there's a way in which the most interesting questions in physics are really metaphysical. Some of the theories that are out there with string theory, unified field theory, and some of these contemporary developments, the base assumptions are really pretty out there. And so I wanted to create a fictional universe in which those things could operate and could move around fluidly. And to that end, not only did I read a lot, I went out to the Stanford Linear Accelerator and talked to physicists and got a tour of, the super collider where they kind of bombard, or in the 70s at least, bombarded, molecules of gold with, electrons traveling at the speed of light. And I guess you've done enough research when you feel like, in my case, the character of the father, I had a sense of how he would respond to things. And, he's his own particular person, but everything he says about particle physics has to be true as well. So I guess that's when you feel like you kind of have created a character who's somewhat consistent in their knowledge.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And when your research kind of circles back on itself to reconfirm what you already knew, probably.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I want to get into the specifics of your craft, and maybe the best introduction is for you to read to us a little bit, and then we can kind of take it from there.
Sure.
Great. I'll remind our listeners that we're listening to Dominique Smith, author of The Beautiful Miscellaneous.
I'll read from Chapter 4, just the beginning of it. Being less than brilliant with a genius parent is like being the bum who stares midwinter through the restaurant window at the plump diners inside. There was my father on the other side of that window, eating food so delicate and sumptuous it made my teeth ache. The seat opposite him was empty and expectant, but I never made it past the glass. I was a mildly precocious child, but my parents mistook two traits as signs of early genius, an ability to pose cutting questions and a slightly better-than-average memory. The first trait was a kind of reflection of the world. Questions made me seem smarter than I was. They mirrored the minds of people around me. I asked my father things that sounded like Zen koans. Why does it snow? Does the sun become a star at night? Why am I the only person I know who's not afraid of Kodiak bears? They seemed like signposts, telegrams from a vibrant interior world, but like most children, I had no sense of irony in my questions. The perfect answer to why it snows was because it gets cold. The second trait, memory, convinced my parents that I was unnaturally gifted. My father posted the periodic table on my bedroom door, hoping I would internalize the names and atomic weights. I remembered 10 elements in no particular order and no atomic weights. I drew arrows connecting the ones that began with the same letter. It was pattern recognition, savvy, but nothing like genius. But my parents' hope outweighed the evidence. A piano appeared in the parlor. My mother's violin came down from the attic. She began leaving it in conspicuous places, casually at rest beside the fireplace, propped on a bookshelf, hoping that I would pick it up one day, take it back to my bedroom, and fill the house with heavenly stringed lament. But the violin sat in its case, marooned in the parlor, sinister as a baby's coffin. I felt it waiting for me, the burnt orange velvet swaying inside, the strings slackening against the bow. I could never bring myself to open the lid.
That's gorgeous. That was Dominique Smith reading from The Beautiful Miscellaneous. That passage raised so many things for me, but one of the striking things about this novel, one of the many, is that it really fired on all cylinders, so to speak. You know, the plot and the characters and their development and their evolution, and then what this passage shows, which is the intricate attention to language and the way words and phrases, you know, join to create this gorgeous imagery. And I read that you were writing this novel amidst and around writing another novel.
Mm-hmm.
How did you achieve the focus and sort of flawless rhythm of this work while your mind was kind of engaged in another piece of work?
Well, I think that the way, you know, kind of my first novel and this novel were in some ways written in tandem, but essentially there was a period of time when I would move from one to the other. And my first novel was a period piece and set in Paris during the mid-19th century, and this is obviously very different. It's contemporary. It's set in the world of particle physics. And for me as a writer, I find it really useful to kind of move from one kind of writing terrain to another. For whatever reason, it kind of, you know, it's almost athletic. It forces me to kind of stretch my muscles and kind of get into a certain way of writing. I find that if I write too much in the same style or within the same kind of milieu, then I just end up feeling kind of like I'm writing the same sentences again and again.
Mm.
So that kind of variety is really helpful for me. And in terms of, I guess, attention to language, really, I've always been a reader that has been drawn to, writers like James Salter and Don DeLillo, people who have this kind of incredible attention to language and the way that the language really ultimately is the key mover in the story. And so that's kind of like where I, you know, that's where I aspire to go as far as like what I want to do with language. It's really one of the key reasons. Language and revelation are kind of the only two reasons that I read fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's there were so many phrases in there that I marked that were just stunning insights. You know, it's hard to achieve plot and character development, and you know, it just was working on all levels. It was really beautiful.
Well, thank you.
I know the other novel was completely different. Like you said, it was set in history. Did you have any sort of sense that the novels were in dialogue with each other at all, or were they, did you kind of put one down and completely walk away from it while you looked at the other one?
Yeah, I mean, I think that now that I've had a little distance from especially the first one, I start to see parallels between the two works, and something that I didn't really know I was interested in as a writer until I'd written these two books. One is kind of science. The first book is all about, you know, photography, and the second book is obviously about physics. And then the other thing is the way that human perception is shaped by illness, whether it's a mental illness or some kind of neurological condition. That also seems to be a recurring theme in some of the things that I work on. And so there is this dialogue, but I'm certainly not aware of it kind of at the time, and it's only later when, you know, a friend will point something out that should have been really obvious to me, but it wasn't, that I start to see these parallels. So there's a relationship there, but I'm not sure that most of the time I'm too aware of it.
Mm-hmm. And how much of the story did you know before you set out? Were you aware that your character would be dealing with synesthesia, or
I knew, you know, if it was kind of a mountain range, I knew what was happening on each of the peaks. I didn't really know what was going to happen in the valleys. The synesthesia actually developed fairly late in the game. I knew that Nathan would undergo some kind of change, but I didn't really know what kind, and that it would kind of reshape the relationship between Samuel and Nathan. But once I happened upon the synesthesia, it really started to kind of, it necessarily changed the shape of the whole book, because it meant now that there was, you know, there was something very concrete I was working towards. And I got really interested in, you know, the different forms of synesthesia, and, you know, I was interested to discover that people like Nabokov and the composer Scriabin both had synesthesia. And so it was a real, you know, gold mine as far as going off and learning as much as I could about it.
Yeah, it wasn't something that I had really encountered before. So it was a lot of great information interwoven in a fast moving plot. So it was really fun to read. And the interesting thing to me is these parent child relationships. And even though I didn't grow up in a household anything like this, how many things in the specifics become universal? And, you know, can you, how much do we owe the next generation, and how much of ourselves are we trying to impose upon them? Mm-hmm. And this relationship between the father and the son was so heartbreaking, even though, you know, you sometimes wanted to strangle the father, but
yeah.
In general, you know, you could kind of see it too. You could kind of see his frustration that, you know.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting realm, and I certainly saw that firsthand when I went out to the Stanford Linear Accelerator and heard stories about, you know, in some ways, FLAC, for its time, was kind of like the NASCAR of particle physics. I mean, if you wanted to win the Nobel Prize, that's where you went, and there have been more Nobel Prizes won in physics within a square mile of that place than anywhere else on the planet. And yet, the sacrifices you hear about families who, you know, trundle after these, and they're usually men, renowned physicists, it raises a lot of interesting questions, like how does that function? What is that like if you're the kid who's moved from one accelerator to another? What is that like if you're the wife? So those are some of the interesting questions to me.
Yeah. The other intriguing thing were your minor characters, because there were a wealth of fascinating minor characters. And some of them served the plot in sort of, you know, they were obviously necessary to the advancement of the plot. And others were just kind of the weird, chaotic characters that you kind of encounter in life. Mm-hmm. And so when they all came together, it was really interesting to see the juxtaposition of these of these people. Characters like Darius Kaplansky and his father, mm-hmm. did they kind of organically walk onto the page, or did you know that they needed to serve a particular function and bring them in?
I think there's a line in there about, you know, Darius being kind of the patron saint of salaried genius, that he's in some ways kind of the specter for Nathan of a kid who really is genuinely, you know, Nicky has the psychologist letterhead to prove it, a genuine genius, and yet he seems thwarted in everything he's doing. Even in the seventh grade, he's kind of the only kid with sloped shoulders in the whole grade. And so I think that, you know, there is a lot of juxtaposition in the book, and I think that for me that's a way, it's kind of a writing technique to, you know, illustrate something about the main characters really by, you know, by contrast and by reflection. And that certainly happens with the father, Samuel, and his kind of unlikely best friend, Whit Shupak, the retired astronaut. They're so different as people, and yet they somehow oddly go together, and when they're kind of in concert, they make more sense than they do just individually.
Right, exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So that's something that I think that I was aware of. And also when you have a character like Samuel who can be very kind of abstract and sometimes stoic, you need someone around him who brings out certain things that wouldn't come out on their own.
Right, right. Yeah, the you know, if you were to map these characters, and I don't know how you, if you go about doing this, but do you map the characters out and kind of their evolution on a, you know, piece of graph paper or something separate and apart from writing the novel? Or
I do sometimes, but only when I really, like, I'm kind of stuck. In some ways, the hardest character was Samuel, because early on in early drafts, he really felt like a stick figure and a cartoon character. And he was like the mad scientist.
Uh-huh.
And I spent a lot of time trying to work. Like, I wanted him to have this kind of dreamlike quality about the way he walked into a room and the way he talked about physics, but I didn't want him to be a caricature. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about how his mind works and what he does, you know, what are his hobbies, and why those hobbies, and what do those hobbies mean. And so, in some ways, it's the strange paradox with character, where it's like you want consistency, but you also want paradox. Because, you know, the people we know in real life are full of paradoxes, and you have to reflect some of that on the page.
Right, right. Yeah, this was really beautifully done. One of the things that I was thinking about with the, I think that it was Samuel who said, and I won't say at which point he said it, but basically you have all this information, accumulative information in your brain, and then what? In the end, you know, all this information is gone, and what's the point? And I was thinking about that as a writer, and, you know, thinking that the beauty of writing these novels is that there's something to leave behind, and there's something concrete after you're gone, you know, that you can leave to someone, and isn't that the joy of, you know, of writing novels as opposed to, you know, being a taxidermist or something?
Right. Yeah, and I think, you know, I think that the thrill, I mean, it is such hard work, but at the same time, the thrill is the idea of creating something that didn't exist before. And, you know, obviously we don't know if anyone's going to be reading a certain book in, you know, 5 years, let alone, you know, 100.
Right.
But just that sheer act of having created something that didn't exist in the world before is obviously very satisfying.
Yeah, yeah. Well, unfortunately, we're almost out of time. But before we go, can you leave us with any advice? Most of our listeners are writers out there, so any writerly advice is always appreciated.
My only writerly advice would be very practical, which is, you know, both my novels were really written kind of on a schedule and having, you know, fixed writing hours, you know, 5 or 6 days a week. And I'm a firm believer that inspiration comes out of the work, and that you have to engage the work and the inspiration will come, rather than, you know, we're sitting on a log somewhere and the inspiration descends. A lot of the times, a lot of the key things come to us that way, but a lot of it is just the discipline and mining the inspiration.
That's great, yeah. Always great advice. Even if it isn't the advice we want to hear, it's always great. Always great advice. Dominique, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us this evening.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Huge pleasure. Thank you. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, Peter Orner, author of the haunting novel The Second Coming of Mvula Shinkanga, will be with me. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'll be right back. Thank you.
come back, baby. Please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays, 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Planetary Radio is Public Radio's only weekly series about space exploration. I'm Matt Kaplan, and I hope you'll join me as we explore Mars, look for life in the universe, and fly through the rings of Saturn. We'll talk with the men and women, scientists and dreamers who are guiding us to a future beyond Earth. And don't forget to enter our weekly space trivia contest. That's Planetary Radio, Mondays at 5:30 p.m. right here on KUCI.
Listen to Riders on Riding, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at KUCI.org. And as I mentioned earlier, this show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit penonfire.com for more details on that. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett for most of this month, and I'm joined now by Peter Orner. Peter was born in Chicago and is the author of the novel The Second Coming of Mvula Shinkongo, published by Little Brown last year, and the short story collection Esther Stories. The Second Coming was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. The book won the Bard Fiction Prize and is being translated into French, Italian, and German. The novel is set in Namibia, where Orner lived and worked in the early 1990s. Orner has published fiction in the Atlantic Monthly, the Paris Review, McSweeney's, the Southern Review, and various other publications. Stories have been anthologized in the Best American Stories and the Pushcart Prize Annual. In 2006, Orner was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship. Currently, he's on leave from San Francisco State University and living in upstate New York, where he is a writer-in-residence at Bard College. Peter, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks. Good to be here.
Great to have you on. Perhaps for those who haven't yet read the novel, you can just kind of lead us into the terrain and kind of tell us how the book came to be.
Sure. The book I lived in Namibia, as you said, in the early 1990s, and what was so great about living there then was that Namibia had just become independent. It was one of the last countries in Africa to become independent. So I got to watch that up close. This was 1991. And it was an amazing thing to see a country that had been through, you know, hell for 30 years, and then, you know, add on to that 200 more years of colonialism, but 30 direct years of conflict with South Africa. So it was a euphoric time, and I was there sort of on the ground at the time to watch that. And after leaving Namibia in 1992, the story of the place stayed with me so long, and I worked on the book for, you know, many years, over a decade, and that's kind of how it started. Was it was an attempt on my part to sort of try and relive that, although you can never do that, right?
Right. what took you to Namibia originally?
I had always been interested in African politics, and I was interested in the anti-apartheid movement when I was in college at the University of Michigan. And I sort of, when Namibia became independent, they actually became independent before South Africa, which was significant, because apartheid was still going on when I was living in Namibia, even though Namibia had been under the control of South Africa. So it was a unique situation. So it was sort of my attempt to get close to, I was interested in South Africa, and Namibia seemed at that time the next best thing, although anyone who's been to either knows that they're vastly different, and I learned that very quickly.
Now you, so I read that you were you went to law school, and you also have a huge interest in human rights.
Right.
I'm a fellow suffering lawyer myself. So
oh, good. You should have a support group.
Exactly. I can relate to the Harriet Tubman tunnel out of the law.
Right.
But so you, I assume kind of a human rights interest took you over there originally, or did you do human rights work when you were there? Or
I was a teacher, similar to Kaplansky in the novel. This was actually before law school. For some reason, while I was there, I thought I wanted to go to law school at the time, and which I can talk about. I'm happy to, because I'm not one of these people who's so running from it. I actually thought it was fascinating in many ways. But I went to Namibia to teach English, you know, like a lot of people do. And at the time, Namibia needed English teachers because they had declared their official language to be English as a way of unifying the country. It was a controversial thing, and, you know, there's a lot to say about that, but that was the decision that the Namibian government made. And so they needed people to teach it because the kids didn't speak English. They spoke Afrikaans. So my job was to try and, you know, turn that around a little bit.
Right.
I had very little experience, I should say, and similar to Kaplansky in the novel, I had no more right to teach than, you know, fly to the moon, but there I was.
That's not true.
Kind of. I mean, I'd never taught. I was in Namibia teaching seventh grade, and, you know, as teachers out there know, and if you're taught, you know, it's like, that's the hardest job in the world. I mean, we should, you know, pay our seventh grade teachers, you know, triple what we pay them, and even that's not enough. And I was thrown in a situation where I was teaching seventh grade, and, you know, I had 50 kids.
Oh, my
God. It doesn't
matter
where you are, but 50 kids, 50 seventh graders is, you know, enough to drive you crazy.
To say the least.
I have to say, I drank a lot after class. As they do a lot in the novel, there's a lot of drinking.
And were you, I assume you can't prepare yourself for an experience like that, but did you know you were going to write about it at the time that you were living through it? Did you write parts of the novel while you were living through it?
No, I had no idea. I knew I wanted to write, and I've always known that. And I remember very distinctly that I wrote a lot when I was there, and they were stories about Chicago, where I'm from. So I would sit there and think about Chicago, and I thought about Namibia a lot from the viewpoint of Chicago after I got home. My brain is always not where I am. Do you ever feel that way? You know, it doesn't matter where I am, my brain will not be there.
Absolutely,
So I knew I wanted to write, but to write about Namibia seemed very daunting, and for 10 years I was afraid. Because I didn't feel that I knew the place well enough, even though I'd lived there for, you know, a considerable 15 months or so. And I I fell in love with the place, but I didn't feel like I knew it.
Right.
And so in writing the book, I actually traveled back as much as I could possibly afford to. Every time I had an extra dime, I would fly back and did a lot of research and reconnected with old friends and kind of did it that way. So I even though I kind of it's a mythical place in my head, it's also a real place.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always fascinating to me when, and you did this so well. Well, I don't know Namibia, but in my mind, you did it very well. When you write about a culture that you're not, you know, necessarily a part of, and when, at what point do you feel like you're enough a part of it where you can, you know, have something meaningful to say about it? And this felt very, you know, like I say, I've never traveled to that part of the world, but I found myself drinking a lot of water while I was reading it.
Well, that's great.
Felt like I was very dry.
I'm glad I made you thirsty.
Made me very thirsty.
I think on the one hand to that, and I think about this a lot, I think we have the right to write about anything our imagination tells us we can. Mm. In some ways, when I write about my family in Chicago, and I often do that, like I almost know as little about them, and you know, if I'm trying to imagine 1940 Chicago, which I'm doing right now, it's almost like I have no more right to do that than I did to write about, you know, 1990s Namibia in some ways. And so I sort of gave myself permission to imagine because, you know, I think it started with just falling in love with a place and then doing my best to understand it, but then also knowing that I would never finally, you know, I mean, I wasn't born there, and I did the very best I could to show my love for it. But, you know, I understand the limitations on that. But I also think we can't be afraid to do that, and I was for a long time. And finally, I just said, you know, I can imagine people, and I've done it before, and this is what I'm going to do. Because most of the characters, even though there's one white guy, Kaplansky, are Namibian, and to me, it finally made no difference.
Right, right. And I think at one point, either in an interview or in the book itself, probably within an interview, you had talked about how yeah, everything is local, and literature is local, and it's. You said it was shocking to you how similar people are across the world, regardless of whether the, you know, regardless of where they are. So
yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I think, you know, like it's that old Tip O'Neill line about politics being local, and you know, just like once you get in a place, you're gonna figure out the local politics pretty damn fast. You know what I mean? I mean.
Yeah.
And I think that to me is always the most interesting thing about living in a new place is that, you know, the concerns are usually similar. You know, people are falling in love, people are getting divorced, this and that. And, you know, that was absolutely the same. And what frustrates me, frankly, unfortunately, is a lot of books about Africa or about Latin America or wherever, you know, tend to forget that, I think. And, you know, I don't know how well a job I did or not, but I tried to, you know, at least remember that, because when I read these books that are, you know, it's so different, it's so this, and I hate them. So, and a lot of travel books I find do that, frankly.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Now, one of the more striking, and like I said to you, I'm hardly original in saying this, but one of the more striking aspects of the novel was its structure. It's written in fragments, and it's, you know, 100 and a lot of chapters long.
Right.
And
got more in the paperback. I added them.
But I had kind of this experience when I was reading it of one of those kind of comic flip books, you know, where they have a picture on each page and then you flip it really fast and you get the full motion.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
love
feeling.
It.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's kind of how it felt to me, because there were these gorgeous images and scenes on each page, and in the juxtaposition of them or in the movement through the novel, you got the whole rounded picture of a country. And so I wanted to talk about structure, how you came to that as your structure, and sort of how you juxtaposed the fragments once you had them.
Sure. That's such a great question and such a something I think about a ton, you know, in a weird way. It's just like, the only thing I thought about for years was how to make a book. For some reason, I tend to write short things. I don't know why. And you know, my favorite, now, you know, I love long books. And but I also read a lot of poetry. So I kind of like a tight, you know, compact moment. And I kept thinking, can I make a novel out of this? I had no idea. And you know, you're mentioning some examples on email, and I think those are great examples. And I think that one thing about a novel is you're, I think you are free to go your own way. And I think finally what helped me with this structure of this book is I was trying to remember what I loved most mm-hmm. and what I hated most about living in Namibia, and that was the monotony.
Mm-hmm.
And but for some reason, after living there for a while, like the days would get, you know, you'd wake up and it'd be, you know, there'd be like this great similarity to the day before, but like some small thing would be different or mm-hmm. something. Someone would say something different. And I kept thinking when I was at my desk, you know, over the years, like the curtain rising and falling on the day.
Mm.
And I was thinking, like, how can I write like a book of days,
mm.
you know, and to capture that sense? Because time moves differently there. That's true. I mean, it moves a lot different than it does anywhere else I've ever lived. And I don't know if that's true just of Namibia or Southern Africa or whatever, but for me, time was different. And so I had to slow down time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the challenge, I think. So I couldn't write a traditional novels that I loved. I couldn't. I wanted to somehow at least try to capture that sense of where, you know, where a conversation could be what happened that day.
Right.
And that happens a lot in the book.
Yeah. Interesting. You know, it's interesting that you had talked about being so influenced by poetry, because the structure of the novel, in both structure and content, the novel felt very influenced by poetry. You know, there was such a compression to your language and a weight to your word choices. Were you reading a lot of poetry when you were writing this?
I always read a lot of poetry. It's funny because, like, you say poetry to a fiction writer, and you probably know it's almost like the kiss of death. You know what I mean? Like, poetry, oh, my God, it's poetic. And I know that's not what you're saying. I really appreciate it.
No.
But it's for some reason, I think because there's so much bad poetry out there.
Yeah.
That like people don't read it. That's real good poetry. And so yeah, I was reading William Carlos Williams like throughout, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I always am. Bishop and, you know, people like that. Always. To show like how much punch you can pack in one line.
Uh-huh.
But I think lately, I don't know what happened to this world, but you know, very few people read poetry anymore. And I mean, you know what I mean? Like the association is like, oh, quote, poetic is sort of lyrical for no use.
Right.
And I think, you know, when you look at something like, you know, Chekhov or Stevens, you know, it's absolutely beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
And yet
yeah.
it's poetic, too. It's like there's a hardness of it. Virginia Woolf. I think I read a lot of Virginia Woolf while I was writing this book, actually, who's, you know, wonderfully poetic and lyrical and also really tough, you know, like brutal. And
I
think... I think I was influenced a lot by her.
Very interesting.
I still am.
Yeah, interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Now, how did you structure the fragments? How did you decide? I mean, I guess the novel takes place in sort of a linear way,
mm-hmm.
but it felt like each fragment had kind of an emotional tone, or it was certainly, you know, told from different viewpoints. Did certain things feel like they needed to go together in order to make a point for you, or was it difficult to? Did you kind of write it linearly? Or?
No, God, I wrote it all over the place. I have a bulletin board and I write mostly by hand, and I'd put it on the bulletin board, and then it would go all around the room,
wow.
and I could just kind of watch the book, and the book was there, like kind of all at once. Something you mentioned, it was like there, and I could see like this whole time frame.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, how do you put that in a book? It's got to go. One thing has to go before another.
Right.
And so I made a lot of hard choices, and you know, I think to a certain extent, you know, I was thinking like Cortazar, you know, you've got a book where you don't necessarily have to read it in order. I was thinking about that idea that that you could be immersed in a day at Goas and this farm. And then you could live in that day, and it wouldn't necessarily need the other days, but the other days would help you to be there more fully,
right.
I think.
Right.
But I mean, sometimes it was arbitrary, and sometimes it wasn't, and the book had so many different orders and structures, and, you know, finally I think I just was like, this is it. The book was a lot longer in its original form.
Okay.
And so I cut a lot of it. To make it tighter.
That's always hard to do.
It was random. I mean, I had all these, I was very, got very into Namibian history, and so I had every piece of Namibian history, which I'm fascinated by, but at a certain point it became less important for the story of these characters.
Yeah, yeah. I'm talking with Peter Orner, and maybe the best thing for us to do now is to hear some of it in action, if you could read just a little bit to us.
Okay, sure. And stop me if I... okay. I thought I would read... Here, I'll read just a little bit of where you can see the place. As I said, the book is set in a school way out in the veld, and there's no town around. There's no village. It's just a school sitting there. Mm-hmm. So this is called Up on the Hill by the Cross, chapter 13. The school hunkers in the center of the farm near the intersection of three dry rivers. The Gamakab heads straight north across the veld, ridges the Tar Road, while the Kuseb meanders west, where it snakes a narrow gorge into the Arango Mountains, the beginning of its long desert haul to the Atlantic. The Tonab River, the Goa's favorite, has no sense of where it's going. It winds beneath Krieger's gleaming razor wire fence, but then wanders back onto Goa's farm, twisting south, where it seems to die out in the scrub. Every evening, the five of us, Pohamba, Obadiah, Festus, Vilho, and I, we'd stretch out on cushions stolen from the staff room chairs and pass around a two-week-old Windhoek advertiser. You didn't read the advertiser for news. You read the Namibian for news. But who wanted news? After a week in the classroom, we wanted the real dirt, the smut, and the glory. A 50,000 rand sweepstake on page 3 and multiple sets of naked breasts in rainbow colors, spirit of the new nation, on the fold-out. It was a good newspaper. Pohamba had it first and read out loud a sampling of that day's headlines. Idi Amin has advanced syphilis. Namibian whites plan mass exodus to Paraguay. U.S. VP Quayle to visit Windhoek. Dog poisoner active in Chumeb. Miss Namibia pageant bathing suit mishap. Photos, page 5. Hey, let's see that last, Festus said. And when we were through with the paper, I'd either sleep or watch the veld. Pohamba liked to say the only absolute of Goas is this, that the same veld that wishes you good night will kick you in the head in the morning. But Obadiah would say, that's blindness. Empty, the veld, you must be looking into your own heart, Teacher Pohamba. Obadiah would say the veld changes so much it's hard to keep track. One day you'll be out walking beyond the Vortecker grave, and there in a place where there had been nothing the day before but nameless scrub will be a rare clump of stink bush. Another day in that same spot, poison mustard berries or the deadly euphorbia. It's not that nothing grows at Goas, it's only it's nothing we can eat. And the grass, the Boers call it upslam because it shoots up overnight. After rain, it's all green here for the day, and the next day it's dry as straw. Watch the dry grass alone, Obadiah would say, how some hours it leans with the wind, other hours it fights against it. And more than the movement, consider the light. In late morning, Urangos to the west look like mounds of peppered cheese. And think of the mirages that pool at the base of those mountains. You walk and you walk and you walk, and that water stretches away, but also every step gets bigger. A pond becomes a lake, becomes an ocean. It's merely a collision of heated and unheated air causing the optical refraction. But what, Obadiah said, I ask, do climatological proofs matter to a thirsty man?
That was Peter Orner reading from his novel, The Second Coming of Mvula Shinkongo, in paperback now by Little Brown. You said in other interviews that you tended to identify the most with Obadiah, who is certainly a main character, but not the narrator.
Right.
Were you ever tempted to tell the story from Obadiah's point of view, or were you kind of ultimately content with Larry?
You know, it's a good question. I think Obadiah really sort of reigns over the place as sort of this. He's an old teacher. He's in his 60s, although they think they're not as old. No one's actually sure how old he is. And he's been on this farm for 30, 40 years teaching third graders. And, you know, he thinks of himself as a failure, but he's a big reader, and he's a lonely guy, and he's an insomniac. All those kind of things applied to me. So I for some reason, he was a way that I could sort of get into the story in from a different angle.
Uh-huh.
Because Obadiah, if I was to tell the story from him, you know, not much would happen because it's all in his head, which is a great danger in my work. So I think in order to have a story that moved, and ultimately there's a love story between Kaplansky and Mavala, so I knew that those two sort of had to be the principals, but I also knew that Obadiah could watch from the sidelines, and he has much to say from the sidelines. I almost think the people from the sidelines are the things people we should listen to most anyway,
mm-hmm.
but they can never necessarily be, you know, the leads.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, the supporting actors are the one I pay attention to.
Mm, that's interesting. I like that. And what was the most difficult aspect of this novel for you, as opposed to, I know you write short stories as well, very good short stories.
Thank you.
Now that you've shifted into the novel form, what's the most problematic part of it for you, and will you stay there, or will you go back to short?
Yeah. You know, they're both so hard for me. I think that, I mean, and in some ways, I mean, you know, I've been writing stories now lately, and the thing about this novel was I wanted to stick with these characters. I didn't want them to leave.
Yeah.
And I think what's so devastating about a story is you have to, you know, you spend maybe a lot of time with people in a story, you as a writer, that's it. Like, they die or something, you know?
Right.
And so in a novel, you know, I was allowed to spend more time with them, but then they still die, and I kind of mourn my characters in the novel, too. So I'm working on a new collection and also a novel. I thought actually writing a novel was almost, in fact, easier than stories.
Mm.
And I know people sometimes think, like, stories are easier or something because they're shorter, but, you know, a novel, you have a lot more room to make a lot more mistakes, and in a story, you don't. And so I actually reveled in the space.
Yeah.
I loved it. But the challenge for me sometimes is to not have that luxury.
Right, right. And, I was almost interested in if you would shift into poetry. I know you said that's kind of a
challenge. Yeah, never. No. No, I have no talent or the ear or... I don't understand metrics, all that stuff.
Oh.
My poet friends are always trying to... They say it's really easy, like the feet, and I can't, no way. So I really like reading poetry and having no idea why, you know, what they're doing.
Right, right.
I love being a complete idiot when it comes to reading poetry, and I will always cling to that.
I like that. Well, unfortunately, we're just about out of time, but do you have any writerly advice? What wisdom do you tell your students?
I hang in there, you know, you know how we always ask a writer if they're writing enough, and, you know, every writer will say, oh, I'm not writing enough, I'm not writing enough, I'm not writing enough, and my advice would be is, you know, read and, like, just live, and that'll help your work a lot more than beating yourself up about not writing, because there's so much bad stuff out there, so make it good.
I like that. I'll cling to that in the next.
Okay. God knows if that works. I mean, you know, just a thought, but anyway.
I need anything to cling to. Peter, thank you so much for taking the time tonight. This was a huge pleasure.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
That was Peter Orner, author of The Second Coming of Mavala Shikongo, available in bookstores now and published by Little Brown. That's all the time we have for this evening. Before I go, I've taken a line of text from Dominique Smith's book that stayed with me. It's actually a line of imagined dialogue taken from Nathan's father, the main character. If we're not careful, life becomes very small. And with that, we can go off and do some more writing. I'll be back with you again next week in conversation with Deborah Dean and Eric Mizell. So until next time, thank you so much for joining me this evening. Good night.
just don't wanna be free.